Guy is a graduate of DePaul University, and I always like to say in Greencastle, so it won't be confused with Chicago, and Indiana University School of Law, and as I recently learned, Carmel High School and junior high school and grade school. He's established a law practice that deals solely with the Second Amendment of the United States Constitution and the many, many related issues. He has many public appearances to his credit and often hosts a Saturday afternoon radio talk show known as The Gun Guy. I met Guy in August 2015 when he spoke at a Tea Party meeting at the Knights of Columbus in North Indianapolis. I fancy myself as at least average in knowledge of American history, but Guy gave me pause. Maybe this will give you pause. The British are coming. The British are coming. What did the British want?
How many people know the answer to that question? and this isn't my primary topic today, but it's something that I always enjoy talking about. I am a Second Amendment advocate, and unabatedly so. I'm not here to advocate for anything today. Really, we're just going to talk about a bit of an update on different Second Amendment-related pieces of legislation that are pending both at the state and federal level that are very significant and really can kind of change the landscape for how we regulate firearms, both in Indiana and nationally. But the talk that Bill referenced is a fun one, and one that I've gotten into quite a bit, because when we talk about the origins, not just of the Second Amendment, but really of this country, it's very easy to point out historically how important the ability to defend oneself and defend one's country was to the actual foundation of this country. And the battle at Lexington and Concord, which, as we know from Paul Revere's famous ride, he was issuing a warning that, in fact, the Redcoats were coming. They were coming to seize firearms. The original battle that touched off the Revolutionary War was fought over gun control. And I'm not here to talk for or against gun control. That's not my purpose at all. But it's a fun historical fact that it makes for a great cocktail conversation. What I really want to get into, as we discussed, is a bit of an update on what's going on both at the state and federal level that really, in terms of legislation, has the potential to significantly, as I mentioned, change how we regulate firearms. I approach this from a couple of different perspectives. I am an attorney. As Bill mentioned, I practice exclusively in the area of Second Amendment. I handle both civil and criminal matters where it appears that someone's constitutional rights have been impaired or infringed in some way. I also own a company called Tactical Firearms Training, where I'm the lead instructor along with some other folks, and we train people in the handling and marksmanship of firearms from everything from introductory level all the way up through our more advanced, what we call our personal protection courses. And then I have a radio show, as Bill also mentioned, on WIBC on Saturday afternoons, 5 to 7, called The Gun Guy, where we talk about responsible gun ownership, we talk about Second Amendment related issues, and anything else that's sort of gun related that may be out there of interest to our audience. And what we've been talking about a lot is what the prospects are for changing the landscape in the area of the Second Amendment, both in Indiana and federally, because there are some things pending that are significant. The constitutional carry bill that was just introduced in the Indiana General Assembly would essentially do away with the requirement for an Indiana license to carry handgun in order to lawfully carry a handgun in Indiana. Now, I say it would do away with the requirement. It would not do away with the actual license itself. And for those that don't know, a little bit of background, in Indiana, to have a handgun on your person or in your vehicle, accessible to you in the vehicle, it's a requirement that you have currently an Indiana license to carry a handgun. To get an Indiana license to carry a handgun, it's just a background check. There's no training requirement. It's just a background check done by the Indiana State Police. You fill out an application on the state police website. They run you through a background check to see if you're a proper person, quote unquote, as defined by statute, to receive a license to carry a handgun. And if you are, it comes in the mail. The idea behind constitutional carry, and this was introduced by Representative Jim Lucas, a Republican from Seymour, and he's introduced this now in three consecutive sessions of the Indiana General Assembly, but the idea behind constitutional carry and where it gets its name is that the Second Amendment of the Constitution says the people shall have the right to keep and bear arms. What's bear mean? It means carry. So if we already have a constitutional right to carry a firearm, why do we have to go back to the state, pay a fee, go through a background check in order to receive our license to carry? We already have a right to do that. In other words, the Constitution is our license to carry. And I've been known to recite the phrase, and I think it applies, that a license or a permit in this context is simply the process by which the government sells back to you a right you already had. Again, that's not to advocate for this, because there are positives and negatives associated with this. Some of the positives are, and I wrote an article recently for the WIBC website where I really lay this out in a lot of detail, but there are already state and federal statutes that dictate who can lawfully carry a firearm. And there are several classifications of what we call prohibited possessors, people that cannot lawfully possess a gun at all. Both state law and federal law define several classifications of prohibited possessors. So if you're caught with a gun and you're a prohibited possessor, for instance, federal law says if you have a felony conviction, you can't possess a gun. Period, end of story. If you're subject to a restraining order that protects a domestic partner or former domestic partner or their child, you can't possess a gun. If you even have a misdemeanor conviction for domestic battery or what we call a crime of domestic violence, you can't possess a gun. And there are several other classifications like that that say this person cannot possess a gun at all. If they're caught with a gun, they go to jail, assuming they're successfully prosecuted. So the idea behind constitutional carry is, if we already classify people who can and cannot possess a firearm, and if you're not one of those people who falls within the classification of a prohibited possessor, then you ought to be able to simply carry a handgun without going back to the state, paying that application fee, and going through that additional background check. Now, what you hear, and where the debate boils down, I think, to brass tacks, is you hear the advocates for constitutional carry say, if you could not get a license to carry a handgun, then you're already a prohibited possessor and you can't lawfully possess a gun anyway, so it's a completely redundant and superfluous process. Then you hear opponents to constitutional carry say, oh my gosh, we're gonna have all kinds of dangerous individuals running around, including criminals, carrying handguns who would not have been carrying a handgun without constitutional carry. So where does the truth really lie? It's somewhere in between. It is not true that everyone who would currently be disqualified from getting a license to carry is already a prohibited possessor under state or federal law. It's tougher in terms of the restrictions that you have to get past to get a license to carry. It's tougher to do that than it is to simply go in and buy a gun and pass the background check at a gun store. At the same time, it's not true that dangerous criminals will suddenly be able to lawfully carry a handgun, because if you're a quote-unquote dangerous criminal, it's extremely likely you fall within one of the classifications of prohibited possessor. But it's an interesting debate, and where I think it may likely come down is how law enforcement views this. And the discussions I've had, both publicly and privately, with law enforcement is that they're not a fan. And they're not a fan primarily because right now, if an officer encounters a citizen, most often at a traffic stop, but it could just be out on the street somewhere, and they determine that person is carrying a handgun. That person either has a license to carry, therefore they're lawfully carrying today, or they don't have a license to carry, which means they're breaking the law. That's a binary situation that a police officer can determine and identify very quickly there on the side of the road or on a sidewalk or wherever that might arise. It's a much more difficult process to determine for that officer whether this person is a prohibited possessor or lawfully in possession of a gun at all. It's going to require a computer check or a radio call or a lot more to determine what may be in this person's background, like that they've been committed to a mental institution in the past, which means they've lost their ability to possess a gun, or they have a felony conviction from another state. How does an officer determine that on the side of the road? And I think the law enforcement opposition to constitutional carry does not bode well for the likelihood that we'll see that, but there's also some momentum behind it, given the continuation of a supermajority of Republicans in the General Assembly this year. One piece of legislation that absolutely should pass, and I am a supporter of this, And that is House Bill 1161, which would give a $200 tax credit for anyone who spends up to that amount of money for, or more, for either training or for a storage device. In other words, if you go buy a gun safe, you can now apply, assuming you pay $200 or more for it, you can get a $200 tax credit. And this is a credit, not a deduction. So you can apply that to your next round of taxes. That's for either a gun safe or for going and taking training. And the reason that I like this a lot is that I think it puts the government in an appropriate role when it comes to Second Amendment rights, which is it's encouraging responsible gun ownership, but not defining it or dictating it. In other words, a lot of people say, well, shouldn't we have a training requirement to get a license to carry a handgun or even to be able to buy a gun? Shouldn't you have to prove you're responsible and safe with that firearm? And I own a training company. My wallet would tell me I should be fully in favor of a training requirement to get a license to carry a handgun in Indiana. But the opposite side of that coin is, do we want the government defining the conditions and limitations on how one can go about exercising a constitutional right? What this does is it provides an incentive to be a responsible gun owner. And I've said for years and years and years, you cannot be a responsible and safe gun owner without training from somewhere. It may be dad who was in the Marines, it may be your neighbor who's a police officer or otherwise trained. You don't have to get your checkbook out or your credit card and go take a training class, but you have to get training from somewhere to be a responsible and a safe gun owner. But do we want the government telling us the conditions under which we can exercise a constitutional right? What I like here is that it provides an incentive to go do what you should do, which is receive training. And to have a storage device, a safe or other storage device, where you can follow a very basic rule of gun safety, which is guns have to be stored so they're inaccessible to untrained or unauthorized people, including kids. So I like that, and it's got a lot of momentum as well. A very controversial bill that you'll see a lot of discussion on is what we call campus carry. This is a bill that would prevent state-owned universities from prohibiting guns on campus. In other words, we're saying, okay, if you're a state university, you may not have a rule that prohibits students or employees from having a gun on campus. And it's got teeth to it because it would provide for civil litigation against a university that violates the prohibition. And it would also allow for the reduction in state funding to a university who violates the prohibition on a policy that precludes firearms on campus. Now, again, you can see where the debate comes here. And there are valid points to be made on either side. Do we want drunk college kids partying on campus having guns? The obvious answer to that is no. Should you lose your Second Amendment rights and your ability to defend yourself just because you're attending college? And you can see, and logical minds and reasonable minds can clearly differ on these issues, but that's now teed up at the Indiana General Assembly through this bill. There's another bill too that hasn't been posted on the Indiana General Assembly website yet, but it would essentially do away with gun-free zones, quote unquote, on state property. That would be redundant of and overlap with campus carry, which relates to state universities. But a lot of folks have noticed, and a lot of the Second Amendment advocates in the General Assembly have noticed, that where we have a lot of dangerous situations arise, including mass shootings, that those tend to happen in places where guns are prohibited, whether that's airport or a school or any number of other places. The club where alcohol is served in Florida, that it's illegal to have a gun there. So a lot of times we see mass shootings in gun-free zones. So a lot of the gun advocates or Second Amendment advocates in the General Assembly are pushing to reduce the number of quote-unquote gun-free zones. And again, you can see how that debate stacks up, both from those people who say, hey, we want less guns in society, we want less people being endangered by guns in society, we should have more gun-free zones. You have other people that say, wait a minute, there's really no such thing as a gun-free zone. There's a place where only bad guys have guns because the good guys don't carry there because it's illegal or they're prohibited. And you can see how that debate stacks up. On the federal side of things, a couple of big pieces of legislation that have now been introduced in the new Congress. And the first deals with national reciprocity. Now, right now, how that works, if you have a license to carry handgun in Indiana, there are 32 states that recognize or give reciprocity to the Indiana license to carry handgun. So you can lawfully carry a handgun in those 32 other states with your Indiana license to carry a handgun. So by definition, there are another 18 out there where you cannot, where it's illegal. And national reciprocity would say if a state gives its own citizens the ability to get a license or a permit to carry a handgun, then that state has to recognize the license or permit of every other state. So that now, if this passes with my Indiana license to carry a handgun, I could lawfully carry a handgun in all 49 of the other states as opposed to just the 32. And here where a lot of the folks on the Second Amendment side of things, I think we could very rightfully be accused of hypocrisy. And by that I mean, we tend to be very focused on states' rights, and including what we think is largely the ignoring of the 10th Amendment in this country, which is obviously that any power not expressly delegated to the federal government is reserved to the states or the people. And when you run through the Constitution looking for an express delegation of authority to the federal government to regulate guns, it's not in there. And how the federal government goes about that is they use the Commerce Clause, where if something has moved in or affects interstate commerce, the federal government can regulate it. I think the one thing that our founders would probably roll over if they knew was how we've used the Commerce Clause in this country basically to allow the federal government to regulate everything. I don't think that was ever the intent, but clearly the Supreme Court has allowed Congress to do that, and that's simply where we are. A lot of us who advocate against federal authority and argue in favor of states' rights and the limitation of federal government generally look at reciprocity and say, okay, well, this is the federal government telling every state what they have to do. It's telling the federal government saying, if you issue a license to carry to your own people, then you have to recognize the licenses or permits of every other state. That's the complete antithesis of states' rights. So if somebody says, Guy, how do you feel about this? I say, you know what? I hate the idea of the federal government telling the states what they have to do, especially when they have questionable constitutional authority to do so. But it sure would be nice to lawfully carry a gun in California. So that's where the hypocrisy comes from, is how do we feel about states' rights versus how do we feel about being able to lawfully carry a handgun in all 50 states. And lastly, on the federal side, we have what's called the Hearing Protection Act, which is Senate Bill 59 that was recently introduced. And this is a big priority of some Republicans. It's a big priority of some of the pro-gun groups out there, NRA, Gun Owners of America. And what the Hearing Protection Act would do is it would take suppressors, or what a lot of people call a silencer, out of the purview of the National Firearms Act. Now, the National Firearms Act is actually called the National Firearms Act of 1934. And it arose in 1934 on the heels of a lot of gangland violence where bad guys like Al Capone and Pretty Boy Floyd and Babyface Nelson and some of those folks were running around doing bad things. And they were doing a lot of bad things with certain kinds of weapons, including the Tommy gun, the Thompson submachine gun, which is a fully automatic gun. It has various nicknames, including the Chicago typewriter. But they became very popular about that time, and bad guys were also using sawed-off shotguns. They were using rifles with barrels cut down to very short lengths, so they were more concealable. And Congress decided that we needed to do something to curtail the availability of those kinds of firearms. So we passed then in 1934 the NFA, and what it did, this was back when Congress was worried about the Second Amendment in terms of a limitation on their ability to regulate firearms at all. So they looked at it and they said, we can't just ban these things because we think that would violate the Second Amendment. We really want to curtail the availability of these things. How can we do that without getting crosswise with the Second Amendment at the Supreme Court? I know, we won't ban them, we'll just tax them. So the National Firearms Act of 1934 is actually part of the Internal Revenue Code. It's in Title 26. Where we have our financial planners, I'm sure, are extremely familiar with that code. The National Firearms Act of 1934 is part of the Internal Revenue Code. And what it says is, if you want to own certain kinds of firearms, and this includes short-barreled rifles, that's a rifle with a barrel less than 16 inches, a short-barreled shotgun, which is a shotgun with a barrel less than 18 inches, a fully automatic firearm, again, they're not illegal, they're just highly regulated, or then there's broad classification, something called an any other weapon, which is basically a concealable gun that you can carry on the body that's not a handgun. Destructive devices, which includes like bombs and missiles and grenades and that type thing. You have to go through this special process where it's an additional background check. and then you pay a tax, which for most NFA-regulated item, it's $200. Where the $200 came from, which that amount, by the way, was set in 1934. And that was, in 1934, roughly the cost of a Thompson submachine gun. So it was intended to be a 100% tax on the purchase of a fully automatic Thompson submachine gun. And they thought, well, if you have to pay for the gun and you have to pay an equivalent amount for the tax, a lot fewer people will buy them. Plus, we're going to maintain a registry so we know who has them. And it'll be a disincentive for bad guys to go out and acquire one of these, because we can throw them in jail for 10 years if we find them where they haven't paid the tax or they haven't registered that gun with the federal government. At the time, in 1934, there was a company founded by a gentleman named Hiram Percy Maxim, where he made a product called a firearm muffler. And he called it a firearm muffler because he was also a pioneer in the area of automobile mufflers. And he used exactly the same technology for a firearm muffler as he did for an automobile muffler, which is essentially a series of baffles inside a metal case that both reduces the pressure and the temperature of compressed gases so that when you ultimately release them into the atmosphere, they make less noise. If you release high pressure gases into a lower pressure environment, like popping a balloon, it makes a noise. So the device simply reduces the pressure inside of a metal tube, and so when it's ultimately released into the ambient environment, it makes less noise. So he had made his firearm muffler, his brand name for his firearm muffler that he was selling in 1934 was the Silencer. So Congress looked at that and said, we don't have any real evidence that people are running around assassinating people with these things, but it sure seems plausible, and we've seen movies where it's happened, so we better include so-called silencers or firearm mufflers within the scope of the National Firearms Act. And so since 1934, if you want to own a suppressor, again, that's the more correct name. And why do we say that? The movie scene that we've all seen a gazillion times in various movies where someone's using a suppressed firearm and it sounds like if that loud, that's a complete myth. It's a complete falsehood. If you've ever shot a suppressed firearm, it just sounds like a slightly quieter gunshot. It takes a gunshot that's around 160 decibels and reduces it to around 130. And to put that into comparison, that's still louder than a jackhammer at 50 feet. It's still louder than a typical rock concert. It's still louder than a jet engine at a couple of hundred feet. So it's not anything close to a silencer in the sense of what a lot of us think of it as. So the idea here is through the Hearing Protection Act is to simply remove suppressors from the scope of the National Firearms Act. They're still legally defined as a firearm. It's a little silly. They don't go bang. The only way you could hurt someone just with a suppressor would be to beat them over the head with it. They are legally defined as a firearm. So to purchase a suppressor, if this passes, you would still have to go into your local gun shop. They could only be sold from a federal firearms licensee, the same people that are authorized by the government to sell guns. You'd still have to fill out the form, which is your application to purchase a firearm, and still have to pass a background check that's run by the FBI out of West Virginia, a group called NICS for National Instant Criminal Background Check System, in order to acquire your suppressor. But what you would not have to do is pay the $200 tax and file the application with the ATF for your registration and permission, essentially, to acquire that suppressor. Those applications, by the way, right now are running about 10 months to process. So you pay the extra $200, you wait 10 months, and now you can acquire your suppressor. This would take suppressors out of the scope of the National Firearms Act, still regulate them as firearms. And the idea behind that is that even the most highly regulated countries in terms of the degree of regulation of firearms, England, France, many of the European countries that very closely regulate firearms, a suppressor is totally legal because they recognize that all it is a way to lessen the report, the noise generated by a gun. And so why are we restricting that, or why would we make it illegal for someone to possess without going through this long and sort of arduous and expensive application process? And there are clearly benefits to having a suppressed firearm when it comes to protecting not only your hearing, but also being a good neighbor in terms of reducing the noise from gunshots. So that's the idea behind it. It is a priority of NRA. It's a priority for this new group that President-elect Trump has established, which is the Second Amendment Coalition, he calls it, which has several pro-gun folks on it, including the legislative director from NRA and several others. They've made it a priority, and so we think it has a lot of momentum, but we'll see where it goes. The Democrats have promised a filibuster, so we'll see whether the votes are there to get around that as well. But those are some of the things happening both at the state and federal level that relate to gun rights, both for us as individuals, and that can also have a significant impact, as I mentioned, especially with constitutional carry, on how police officers are going to interact with people with guns in society. But that is it. I'd be glad now to open it up with questions. I know Kelly has a microphone, and I'd be glad to talk to anyone and everyone about whatever you'd like to talk about.